Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA.
It's Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. One of the two solstices that we mark every year is early this coming Friday morning. Summer begins in the Northern Hemisphere at 1:04 a.m. this Friday. I'm not entirely sure why I always look forward to that. I do enjoy that. I know many others who enjoy it too. It's not just me. It's all the sunlight, I think, is what it is. There's more living to do when the sun shines longer throughout the day. I think that's it. And the good news for Friday is it's supposed to be mostly sunny. So there you go. The summer officially arrives, 1:04 a.m. Friday morning. Coming up, learn more about Lansing's new cogeneration plant from the Board of Water and Light that is going online July 1st. Kevin Lavery checks in on that, and also meet the independent party's candidate for governor of Michigan, Robin Sanders. That is on the way. At the top of the program today, last week, Bridge Magazine highlighted a study conducted by the Education Trust, a Washington, D.C.-based education research and policy group that showed Michigan had one of the worst rates in the country for enrollment in advanced placement and international baccalaureate classes among low-income and minority students. Enrollment in these higher-level classes during high school greatly increases a student's chances for success in college. Our next guest also says that increasing enrollment in AP and IB classes is one of the better short-term options we have to improve education at the school, district, and state levels. Christina Theokas is the Director of Research at the Education Trust and is the co-author of this study, and she joins us by phone from D.C. Welcome, Christina.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Our pleasure. What led you to focus on advanced placement and international baccalaureate classes for this study?
We were really interested in exploring ways to resolve the high-end achievement gap problem that exists. Over the past decade or so, we have really helped move students out of the below basic category of performance, but we have found that we're having a hard time moving students to advanced levels of performance. And in particular, the only progress we've seen at the high end is with white and more affluent students. So AP and IB is a sort of an existing strategy we have right now to improve academic achievement at the high end for students in high schools right now.
I imagine most of our listeners understand what advanced placement is about. International baccalaureate gets a little bit less ink. Why don't you tell our listeners what international baccalaureate is all about?
Yeah, so international baccalaureate is very similar to the AP program. You can take a single class, and it's a rigorous college-aligned class that is validated by high school teachers and college teachers. Or you can do the International Baccalaureate Diploma Program, which is is taking a sequence of classes as well as taking and doing some community service and being more civic-minded. So it has a little bit more of an international component as the diploma program, but similar to AP, you can take a single course that is rigorous and aligned to college-level expectations.
And the bottom line is it's about introducing college-level content into a high schooler's regimen. Before they graduate from high school.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's giving kids an understanding of what college-level courses are like and really challenging students in high school with a different level of rigor than is often experienced by most kids.
So tell us a little more about the report. What did you measure, and what did you find out?
So we had two questions, and the first question is really, where does the problem exist? Does the problem exist between schools, or does the problem exist within schools? We have found over the last 10 years that there has been incredible program expansion, particularly with the AP program, with more and more kids participating, and also more kids participating, more students of color and low-income students participating. But with that, most other studies have found gaps in participation. So we really wanted to look and say, okay, where is the AP program? In what schools is the AP program? That was our first question. question, and we found that about 71% of high schools offer the AP program, and those 71 high schools serve about 91% of the student population. And we found that most student subgroups are reached equitably with the AP program. So the reach has really expanded, as we have seen, but when we look at the overall participation rates for the high school student body, we see really big gaps in participation between student groups. The IB program, as mentioned, is a much smaller program, but when we look at that program as well, we see it has been expanding over the past number of years, and then we also see gaps in participation occurring. So we know that we have seen that expansion. More students have access to the program, but what we found, our next question was, well, what's happening within schools? Which students are actually enrolling in the program? And we found that there are very wide in-school participation gaps between students, and if we actually close the participation gaps within schools, meaning that white students and students of color participated at the same rate within their school, whether it be 3%, 10%, or 20%, that those gaps within schools could close the national, almost entirely close the national participation gaps that we see. And if you calculate the number of students that are missing within those gaps, it's more than 500,000 students. So there are a lot of students out there who could be participating in the program who are not right now if they were being equitably served by their schools.
And did you go so far as to look at ways that that participation gap can be closed?
Absolutely. That was our next question. So if this gap exists, what are the barriers that are preventing students from enrolling in the program? And we find that there are a number of things. AP and IB have historically been elite programs, or programs for elite students. So there's a lot of both explicit and implicit barriers that still remain as a result of that. There's just a belief system out there by many of our educators, students, and their families about who those programs are appropriate for. When you talk to students, oftentimes they say, I look in the doors of those classrooms and I don't see anyone else who looks like me, because they don't see any other black or brown students. And they think it's only for some kids. Teachers also think that. There's also
Teachers think that too?
Absolutely. It's only for a small group of students and only for the most trained students over time, only the students who are going to college, as opposed to looking at the program as an opportunity for kids to really be challenged with a level of intellectual rigor that they don't experience in their other classes.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Christina Theokas. She's the Director of Research at the Education Trust in Washington, D.C., about a study that showed suggested advanced placement and international baccalaureate participation is much lower among low-income and minority students here in Michigan. Are you recommending some awareness raising then?
Yeah, absolutely. We do a couple case studies to look at schools who have really worked on this and changed their patterns of participation to be much more equitable. And one of the first things that those schools have done is just examine student and teacher knowledge about the AP and IB classes. We find often that people just don't know about what is required to be in these classes. We also recommend that schools audit their entry requirements. Typically, enrollment in these programs is an opt-in program, and the responsibility falls to the students to get teacher recommendations, to make it work for their master schedule. And one of the districts that we learned from changed it from an opt-in program to an opt-out program. So what they did was they automatically enrolled students who passed their state tests or end-of-course tests with an appropriate score and automatically enrolled them into the AP program.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I find it surprising that you're suggesting you need to raise the awareness of teachers here, though, as well. You would think that our teachers would be quite familiar with this process and the payoffs.
Yeah, AP, depending on what school it is, it's only a certain select group of teachers who actually teach in the program. Other teachers don't know about it. Counselors sort of have some rigid placement programs for kids to put them into classes, and it really means thinking very differently about the master schedule, how many classes need to be offered to reach all of the students who are eligible to participate in the program. So there's definitely a lot of work to be done with staff as well, and the schools that we work with and have learned from have really done a lot of sort of consciousness raising that students of color and low-income students are also eligible for these classes as well.
Is anybody doing the opt-in, the automatic opt-in system now, or would that be, is that something brand new that you're proposing?
Yeah, it's a suggestion that comes from Federal Way Public Schools in Washington State. It's their first change that they made at the district level. So the district has a responsibility in regard to the policies that their district has. So they changed it to an opt-out program. Then each of the schools had to work and think about what they needed to do differently to meet the needs of the kids, because far more kids were now in these classes. So they had to offer more classes. They had to train more teachers and really figure out how to serve all of the students. So we find it's a great strategy. They have closed their participation gaps and have no more missing students, and are continuing to try to expand the program and offer more classes to students.
I have to ask you about Common Core, since we are one of the two states that just decided not to fund the Common Core standards here in Michigan. It seems your organization is quite an advocate of the Common Core standards. What do you make of Michigan and Indiana and our decisions not to fund that?
Yeah, I think that the Common Core, so we know we have this high-end achievement gap problem, and the Common Core offers us more rigorous standards to teach students too. And I think the standards are the first part of that process. It's helping teachers and students understand what is expected at this high level. So the standards won't solve all of our problems, because we need to really work on implementation and think about what training teachers need to be able to do it, what resources they need, but it's a really good first step to be able to actually reach the level of rigor we want to for our kids and improve the achievement of all students.
When you meet someone who is against the Common Core standards, how vigorously do you try to persuade them otherwise?
Well, one of the things is that I think there's a lot of sort of misinformation out there right now about the Common Core standards, so people have lots of different perceptions about what they are and what they're going to do. And I think for me, one of the things I like to tell people is, when I go out and talk to educators in schools, most of them really want this and are really excited about it and feel it's really going to help their instruction and help them to know what we really want students to be able to know and be able to do at the end of high school that's going to match the demands of our country and our economy. So I think that's one of the more powerful arguments, is that teachers really want this. They're going to need support and resources to be able to do it effectively, but it's something that they are looking forward to.
Christina Theokas is the Director of Research at the Education Trust and is the co-author of the study, Finding America's Missing AP and IB Students. Thanks, Christina, for joining us.
Thank you.
Current state on WKAR, the massive cogeneration power plant rising above Lansing's Rio Town neighborhood is nearly complete. The Lansing Board of Water and Light's new 46,000-square-foot facility has been under construction for more than 2 years. The power plant officially comes online July 1st, and it will replace four coal-fired steam units at the nearby Morris Park plant built back in the 1950s. The BWL says the new plant is much more environmentally friendly. Residents and business owners believe it'll also bring some economic gain to their neighborhood. In Current State's Kevin Lavery toured the new plant with the Board of Water and Light's general manager, Peter Lark. Sounds like a fun assignment, Kevin.
It was a ball. We were over there on Thursday, Mark, and it was just agog with activity outside.
I'm sure.
Yes.
It's a big, expensive new facility.
It really is. There's much that is still going on outside the facility in terms of repaving some roads and putting in some new concrete. One of the great things that's really nice about the area is the old Grand Trunk Western Railroad Depot, which you'll hear about here in just a moment. It's about a 110-year-old building that saw a lot of rail traffic over the years and fell into disrepair many years ago. It went through different iterations. It was a restaurant for a while, and then it had been defunct for maybe 40 years, and the Board of Water and Light has completely refurbished that as to be basically a meeting space for the Board of Commissioners there.
Yeah, everybody's driven by that. They know what you're talking about. Cogen means it'll produce both electric and steam power, which is what the BWL has always done. It runs on natural gas, though, and anybody who saw this morning's Lansing State Journal cover story, it was about the T.B. Simon power plant. here at Michigan State University and how it burns biomass. This plant could also do that, but that's in the future?
Right. That's something that could be down the road. Right now, as you'll hear from Peter Lark in just a moment, their main concern now is getting the plant up and moving and up off the ground. And I think we're going to be hearing about that in just a moment here, but that's something in the future. That's something that that could be on the way. But for the moment, they're just trying to get natural gas power to get the plant up and running. So
okay, and economic development, I understand, is really being touted here by the proponents of this new plant.
It is. Many people are calling this the Rio Town Renaissance. For many years, the neighborhood was not in the best economic shape, and it is truly coming back over the last few years. And there are different restaurants that are slated to open. There are buildings being renovated nearby. The Cadillac Club in that area is being sold, actually, we've recently read about, to a church based in Holt. So there are many things that are going on, and here's what my trip sounded like. The Rio Town Cogen plant in South Lansing dwarfs the growing row of storefronts and startups that line Washington Avenue. Its brick and glass facade stands in silent salute to another emblematic giant that once stood on this street, the formidable Rio Motor Car Company, torn down nearly 40 years ago. But there's still a small piece of the past here. I met Peter Lark right outside the plant, a few feet from where the BWL is restoring the old Grand Trunk Western Railroad Depot. This long-abandoned Tudor Revival-era train station was built in 1902.
You know, the depot is on the U.S. and the Michigan Historical Register, and we've tried to bring it back to it the same charm level it had back in 1912. And as you can see, it's got a brand new roof on it. And that roof was manufactured by the same company in Ohio that made the original roof 100 years ago, to the same plans.
Somebody was very meticulous and had an eye for history and made a mental note to say, let's do this right.
Yeah, there was pressure on me to maybe put up shingles in lieu of those, but it didn't seem like the right thing to do.
As construction continues outside the plant, inside, the roar of heavy machinery says it's open for business. Peter Lark leads me beneath a menagerie of pipes, valves, and air ducts to the combustion turbines, where natural gas will produce both steam and electricity.
They have about 60,000 horsepower, $17 million each, one there and one there. They start spinning, generator provides electricity. The effluent or exhaust goes into these big boilers with little tubes in them with water. Water turns to steam and it goes out the back end.
This plant is fairly close to the Grand River, but it's not on the Grand River. Does it have its own separate cooling system independent from the river?
Yes. Yes, it does. And I should tell you that it is not in the floodplain. It may be close to the water. I can't tell you how close it is, but that the Eckert's station there is in the floodplain. And that's another thing we were looking at when we purchased this. We wanted to make sure it was close to the steam lines, close to electric lines, close to natural gas, and also it is out of the floodplain. So that's a good thing for us.
We ascend the staircase to a quiet encased overlook. In the control room, a half dozen workers scan computer screens.
One of the interesting things here too is you have an ability to look out and see what you're controlling. As opposed to some of our other plants, you're pretty much in a locked up room, you can't really see anything. So we think will make it a little more exciting for the employees working here. They can see what where they're operating. From this location here, we can also operate our chiller plant. The new plant we built several years ago back in downtown Lansing. In fact, I believe that's the chiller plant screen right there, and the rest are to control this plant.
We step back outside to avoid any more shouting on the main floor. We're not far from the three towering sentinels that mark the Lansing skyline. Anyone who's ever spent any time in this town knows the Eckert Power Plant smokestacks by their nicknames, Winkin', Blinkin', and Nod, an homage to Eugene Field's classic poem. Lark says the new plant is already carrying much of the old plant's load.
Right now, we have turned off the four steam units across the street at Eckert. So those are no longer operating. We are operating on the auxiliary boiler alone. If that should fail, We have a backup across the street on the electric turbines. We have a way, a header system that allows us to take some steam from the electric generating units and send it into the city. We don't expect to use that, but that's our backup. We also could run those steam units again, but the plan is between now and July 1, and we're about 2 weeks out, the plan is those four units are done. We've got three small generators over there, three small turbines. We call them 1, 2, and 3. They produce only electricity. We will not shut them down, though. We're going to wait this summer because in the summer it gets hot. The summer there's a lot of demand. We would like to have 1, 2, and 3 just sitting there, sort of in backup. But I would say after summer, certainly into the later fall, 1, 2, and 3 will not see much work again.
Where will this plant, Peter, fit into Michigan's renewable portfolio standard? I think the buzz phrase you hear sometimes is 25% renewable energy by the year 2025. Does this plant meet or exceed that, or will it?
No, it has nothing to do with that in a way. But, you know, in the energy business, there are no simple answers. So I'm going to say it has nothing to do with it, but that's not really true because this is running on natural gas. The nice thing about natural gas is we can burn biofuel. Now, to be honest with you, we're looking at it, but we have not, right now we're trying to put the plant up. But as things go on, if we can get a good source for biofuel, because this is going to use a lot of natural gas, if you can find a source, and that's one of the things we've had problems with, even though we can burn some cleaner things in our coal-fired plants, we can't get anybody to tell me, here, I'll give you this at this price and this much, and I guarantee it. Because people around here don't want to run out of electricity. So this plant gives us the capability to do a lot with biofuels, which would help us with the renewable portfolio standard. The other thing, though, that we're doing here that does contribute, only a little because we don't have enough room, is we are going to have solar on the roof. So we'll have solar panels on the roof. We are going to have a fuel cell here, a hydrogen fuel cell, and we are going to have a green roof. So we are looking for LEED certification, and I believe we will get it. Very few power plants have LEED certification.
The building itself may be green, but what really counts is the air above it. I asked Peter Lark about pollution control. A couple of years ago when the groundbreaking was going on, one of the big selling points was the environmental benefits of a newer, cleaner plant. If you can speak about how things like nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, mercury, how that will be reduced with this plant versus how it's been for decades.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, Kevin. You know, because I think that's the piece of this plant that has gotten lost in the translation over the last 3 or so years. What this will do for the city of Lansing, as far as cleaning up the air, is just incredible. We just put something out on how much coal we won't burn. 375,000 tons. Let me repeat that. 375,000 tons of coal burning will not take place after this comes online.
Per year?
Per year. It'll be a 50% reduction in carbon from those units we just talked about, the 4 steam and the 3 electric. To this. I mean, 50% reduction in carbon, that's tremendous. SOx and NOx, oxides of nitrogen and sulfur dioxide, are going to be up in the 90s as well. These are tremendous reductions.
The Lansing Board of Water and Light hosts the official grand opening of the Rio Town Cogeneration Power Plant on July 1st, starting at 9 o'clock. For Current State, this is Kevin Lavery.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Many Michigan voters have begun anticipating a gubernatorial contest next year between Republican incumbent Rick Snyder and Democratic challenger Mark Schauer. But a political neophyte from southeast Michigan has also launched an effort at getting the state's top job. Robin Sanders has spent close to 20 years as a corrections officer with the Michigan Department of Corrections, most of it specializing in mental health work. That was preceded by a 20-year career in the U.S. Navy, featuring tours of duty both in Vietnam and in Kuwait and Iraq as part of Operation Desert Storm. Robin Sanders is married with 5 adult children and stepchildren, 3 grandchildren, and Robin Sanders joins us now to talk about his effort. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
It's good to meet you. What made you launch this effort? Was it a particular issue or a combination of issues or what?
A combination, primarily because I have been a public safety professional for over 39 years of my adult life. I became a public safety advocate and lobbyist here in recent years, primarily for my union, which is Michigan Corrections Organization. And during one of my meetings with an elected official who shall remain nameless, he told me and some of my colleagues at the time that the legislature was more concerned about money than they were public safety. And that cut through me like a knife. And that was really the go moment for me to go into politics, because I saw that, I recognized that as a defining moment, that if that was the case, it really fired me up to say, okay, I have to get into this, because I see other issues also with education and other public services that seems to be caught in the crossfire between the major political parties.
What I mean, the governor claims to be very concerned about public safety as well. He made that a focus of here in the past 12 to 18 months, I would say. What improvements, what does Michigan need to address relative to public safety specifically?
Well, we need to stop looking at the budget issues with people having the, I would say it's a misunderstanding of how money is spent in public safety, particularly in state prisons. We have a large amount of mentally ill prisoners that were absorbed from the state hospitals closing through several administrations. So that added to the cost of corrections tremendously. We also have an aging population who are experiencing a lot of health issues, which comes with age. All these combined has made it appear that we are spending too much money on corrections when the exact opposite is true. We need to spend more, but in the right areas. And our governor and our current director have made tremendous strides in trying to address these issues. And I respect them very much for what they've tried to do. They have made progress. However, I believe that because of my experiences in my life, that I am better qualified to address these issues, to basically pick up the ball from here and run with it, take it where it needs to go.
We've discussed on this program, or we've had guests on this program who insist that the state has many people incarcerated who really are more deserving of treatment by mental health professionals than they are deserving of a jail cell. Are you one of those people?
Oh, most certainly.
Is that the point that you're making, I guess?
Exactly, okay. Exactly. That we're working harder and not smarter. We need to focus our resources in helping people who do have these issues that are not necessarily criminal issues. It's tied in. I mean, mental illness and criminal behavior are linked to some extent. However, in Michigan, it's very unfortunate that we do have very severely mentally ill and even some who have been incarcerated for minor mental illnesses, that because they were incarcerated, it exacerbated their mental illness, which caused them to have more problems while they're in prison, placed in segregation units, caused multiple behavioral issues for them, which just caused a multitude of problems, not the least of met, which is increasing their length of incarceration.
There's a lot of other issues, obviously, that are on the plate of a governor besides mental health and public safety. How good of an understanding do you think you have of all the other issues that we hear about day in and day out here in Michigan? Education and health care and road funding and all of that.
Well, I'm a product of public education. I was attended Washtenaw Community College under the GI Bill to learn my trade in correctional science. I'm still attending Washtenaw Community College, pursuing a certificate of computer technology. And I've seen, another thing that bothers me is I've seen money slowly drying up and funding of education and roads. And it all stems to a lot of it is the bad politics that leads to bad public policy. I've seen this through my whole life, starting out in 1972 when I went in the Navy, in Vietnam, in Desert Storm. Things are implemented in the wrong ways because of a lot of bad politics. which leads to bad public policy.
It takes a lot of money in 2013 and an organization to win an election like this. Are you forming an organization? Are you raising money? What sort of staff do you have set up?
At this point in time, because I'm still employed by the state of Michigan as a corrections officer, civil service rules prevent me from getting any money or filing to run. As far as getting together an organization, not at this time. I am trying to reach out to the public through stations like this as a public service, because that's what I'm all about. I've been a public service servant for over 39 years of my adult life, so it's appropriate that I try and reach out to the public through public radio.
Is this something that you would quit your job over so you could embark on a more conventional campaign?
Well, actually, I'm in the process of retiring. I'm 58 years old, and for what I'm doing now, it's really a young man's game. I'm still hanging in there. I'm still in good shape, but I want to move on to my third career.
But you have no intention of quitting your state job to continue your pursuit of the governor's office.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. I'm in the process of retiring. I hope to retire this year to move on to the next chapter of my life.
Why should people take this effort of yours seriously, Robin? With all due respect, how do you plan on getting the electorate to take you seriously?
Well, it's a simple matter of examining my record of my accomplishments in my life and to have a conversation with me. I will go to any public venue, any private event to speak with people so they can basically pick my brain to see if they are confident that they will believe, as I believe, that I am the most qualified person at this point in time to be the governor of the state of Michigan.
Sometimes candidates will acknowledge that they have no chance of winning but are motivated by a desire to popularize a particular issue. Do you feel that way about the public safety thing? I mean, if you generated a good, vigorous debate about public safety in Michigan and still got clobbered in the election and still really didn't place, how would you feel about that?
I would take it with a grain of salt. You know, what I'm doing now is I'm trying to bring all these things up so that all parties, all people will look at things objectively and stop allowing ourselves to be divided on issues that we can all agree to disagree about, but we should come together to agree about issues that concern everyone.
And are you affiliated with the Independent Party, or are you not affiliated with a party?
No, I'm not. I'm actually, here in Michigan, it's technically called no party affiliation.
Okay, very good. Robin Sanders is a candidate for governor for the state of Michigan. Thank you very much for joining us. Good luck.
Thank you very much for having me.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. 3D printing was in the news recently when a Texas group called Defense Distributed posted instructions on its website for printing a functional plastic handgun using a 3D printer. Although the State Department had the group remove the postings, the story brought 3D printing to the headlines, and we here at Current State wondered about this new technological frontier. So for some basic lessons on 3D printing, we've brought in Dr. Patrick Kwan. He's a professor of mechanical engineering here at Michigan State University. Welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, what is 3D printing?
Basically, what manufacturing people do is they will develop drawings of the product, and then they'll try to make that product. So in 3D printing, what they do is they make a CAD file, which is a computer model of that product, and trying to do as simple as possible how to go from that model to real product. So, for example, in that plastic model, what they do is there's a few technology to do it, and one of the ways that they do is UV light sensitive polymer. So you start with a liquid polymer, and then you focus these UV light at certain location, start solidifying these materials.
Mm-hmm.
So we call that curing. So we start curing certain area one point after another, and then you can start building these models.
I think what hangs a lot of people up, and what hangs me up to an extent, is the fact that people think of printing as a two-dimensional process, obviously we're talking about a three-dimensional process here, which changes the whole thing.
It's put a lot of effort needs to go in order to be able to do that. So, for example, you can start it with a plate with these material to be built, so you can start adding it one layer at a time. So you start adding these materials, and then this plate will lower down and start adding another set of material. So you can start building these into very complicated shape.
Many of us have never seen a 3D printer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have them in the engineering department?
Yeah, it is in our engineering building. So this is only for polymer that has been probably most closest as the real material. But when you go into a metal and ceramic and other material, it becomes a little tougher.
And a polymer, remind us what a polymer is here again. It's a hard plastic?
Yeah, it is hard plastic, yes.
Okay. And are these 3D printers, are they large? Are they the size of a conventional printer, paper printer?
I think there are someone that said small as a paper printer. Now it's existing.
Wow.
But there are something bigger. For example, GM wants to make a prototyping of the big part, then they have to use a bigger environment to do it, right? So this whole thing actually started as back in 60s and 70s, trying to go from a CAD file to CAM file, what they call. So CAD is the model of the product.
Computer-aided design to computer-aided manufacturing.
So what these CAD file has become is that they can now generate the code that will feed into CNC machine. So you can actually get these...
A printer.
Well, it's not a printer,
a printer
in that case. That was I'm talking about 60s and 70s people are doing that.
Okay.
And then they want to go even quicker. Just go directly, feed the code into this printing machine, and you can actually make it into a part.
Now, are any of these in use by the general public now, or not?
Those are available. Some of the plastic parts can be made.
Could I find a 3D printer here in the Lansing area? I mean, you've got them in the engineering department.
Yeah, yeah, we have some students actually make a model out of it and actually print it into a product, and so they can actually use that for their design.
What did they make?
Oh, it varies depending on the research. Anything that could be made out of hard plastic could theoretically be made
in your lab.
Yes,
now,
that can be.
There's huge implications here. Yeah. Economically, especially here in a traditionally manufacturing, car manufacturing town. What do you make of that? I mean, is this decades down the road before this thing plays out, or do you think this will be playing
already,
out quickly?
Yeah, I think it's already in. I mean, I only talk about one UV-sensitive ones, but there is a many other type of polymeric material that you can do. So some of them are probably very close to a functional part. One of the technique that I didn't mention is it's like a toothpaste. So thin polymeric material will get deposited, just like a toothpaste will.
Right.
And then start building layer by layer. So you can build into something. But as you can see, because of the way they made it, it's not really at the strength level that most of the polymeric material that you see on the market.
And nothing is being made with 3D printers now that's metal?
There is a metal, but there's still, for example, if you are in making the metal, you have to start it from a liquid molten metal, and then they make a mold, and then they introduce these molten metal into these cavity, And then when you cool it down, it becomes that part. And then you have to do a few more steps to get to the actual part. But you can actually go from molten metal to there. But the big problem is going from molten metal to the solid metal, there is a shrinkage that occurs, and you have to control all these things in order to do that. And in order to do 3D printing in metallic material, the biggest issue is that you can melt the metal, deposit one, and that has shrank. And then if you put it on top of it, there's another metal that will try to shrink, so they will cause some what we call residual stress one another.
Okay.
So which weakens the structure.
We're talking with mechanical engineering professor Dr. Patrick Kwan of Michigan State University about 3D printing. What excites you the most about this technology?
I think one of the, big orthodontic in application. I don't know whether you heard the Visalign. So when you do the orthodontic. Those are 3D printed.
Invisalign.
Yeah, Invisalign. Yeah, Invisalign. Those are, so if you are trying to make, so in that product, individual has a different geometry that they have to go to, right? So you start from one and eventually changing into a
This is a dental alignment system for our listeners who don't know about Invisalign. Yeah. So that already employs 3D?
That is actually being used.
How about that?
Yeah.
Folks who watch, our listeners who have watched Star Trek might be familiar with machines that make a cup of hot tea for Captain Picard. Do you know if any work is being done on printers that can synthesize food? I have to ask.
Oh, that I do not know. I'm not a food expert, but I'm more a metal and ceramic person. So, those are the 3D printing into metal is another challenge. And then I'm sure some people claim they've done it, but there's a shrinkage that occurs and there's some residual effect. And so I don't think it's at the level where you can actually take these part and put it into your car.
I would think that recreating food products, though, might be relatively easy compared to some of the items that you're talking about here.
I'm not sure about that. Food may be a little different story.
We've discovered the next frontier of 3D printing here this morning on Current State. It's food. How did you happen to become interested in this?
Oh, 3D. Well, as a researcher, I start playing with the powder processing. So there's one technique where you can actually put these metallic powders into a mold and then compact it and sinter it and make it into a product. So that becomes a natural link to 3D printing because you can actually put the layers of these powders and put chemicals which will bind these powders, and then you can start layering up on top of each other and then blow out the loose powder, and you got a shape of that product.
How about
that? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Dr. Patrick Kwan is a professor of mechanical engineering here at Michigan State University, and we've been deciphering 3D printing. Thank you, Dr. Kwan.
Okay, thanks a lot.
When a beloved dog becomes seriously ill, owners are faced with difficult decisions. Researchers are developing a new tool which could help dog owners tackle the tough choice of prolonging life or letting go. And here with us now to discuss the study is Maria Iliopoulou. Maria is an MSU-trained veterinarian and a doctoral student in the Department of Community, Agriculture, Recreation, and Resource Studies. Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you.
How important are owners' observations of changes in a dog's behavior to diagnosing what's wrong? I imagine those are pretty central.
Yeah. It's important to begin with. like based on 93%, based on the research, 93% of the owners perceive their animals as family members. So based on that, and in this research, we had the owner that was closest to the pet to evaluate the quality of life through treatment. And it is very important. And like the scientists and veterinarians know the science, the owner knows the pet. So we wanted this collaboration and this discussion to be based on what we both know to facilitate the decision.
Did you find out what you were looking for through this
study?
Okay.
Yeah.
In a nutshell, what was that?
Well, the one of the findings was that when pets have the play behaviors, or they have signs of disease, or they're perceived as happy by the owner, these are very important findings to include in further studies or to evaluate the quality of life of the pet that is undergoing chemotherapy. And another important part of it was that we had the animal to be a control of itself. Like, we evaluated the pet 6 months before. Like, we asked the owner how your pet was 6 months before it became seriously ill, in order to see the individual animal, what they like, what is happiness for them, how they respond, what is quality of life for the individual dog, and then evaluate it through 3 consecutive visits. And then based on the results of the study, these 3 observations of play behaviors, signs of disease, and happiness of the dog were very much important, as perceived by the owner, to be included.
Okay. And you found this process helps those dog owners who feel guilty, specifically guilty, when a pet dies. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult. This is a heart-wrenching experience for all pet owners.
Sure.
And when eventually the pet is euthanized or dies, you're thinking about what happened. So based on some experience, it was mentioned by Dr. Villalobos as well, who is she's treating cancer, pets with cancer. When they have this scale to know in every step what they did and why, or why they continued treatment or they didn't, that helps them feel better or understand why they made those decisions versus having all this emotional feeling guilty or the roller coaster of emotions.
What do you consider the single biggest takeaway from the study?
Well, the 3 the consecutive evaluation of the dogs, that's very, very important. And then also these 3 findings of play behaviors, happiness as perceived of the owner, and signs of disease, but also to be a consecutive and fluid evaluation, not just one time, because it wouldn't make sense. We want to see how the dog responds to treatment over time.
And what are you thinking of next in terms of a follow-up? Logical questions that this study leads to?
Sure. We would like to see, something we included in the study was, for example, the caretaker effect, which is something that is noticed.
The caretaker effect.
Like for example, that comes from the human literature of pediatric patients. Their parents, when their child is undergoing chemotherapy, they might feel overwhelmed and might be tired, or they have depression. So that impacts how they perceive the quality of life of their child. So we're trying to explore if that exists also in veterinary cancer patients. And we didn't have any results. We didn't have any positive results at this point. So we'd like to explore that, and also to scale up the study with a bigger population and include more questions to further the research in this area.
You're also interested in outreach and educating communities about basic dog care. What work are you doing there?
So what I'm doing there is like develop an intervention, develop a scale practically at this point, and to evaluate what information kids need to know at schools in order to be to take care of a dog, very very basic cares care of a dog, like water, food, shelter, medical care, and that is something very new. So we want to explore for each school what kids know and what we need to include in that intervention. And also another component of that study is how the knowledge the kids have about how to take care of a dog in this case associates with perceptions of animal abuse. Like if a child didn't have a pet and they don't know what a pet needs, they might think that abuse is not that bad. In mm-hmm. this case, it's dog fighting. Mm-hmm. Because one of the justifications is that the dogs that participate in dog fighting, they don't feel pain and they enjoy fighting. But we all know that all animals feel pain. So, but a child and that's a way to identify the need to have these interventions in schools. So all kids know how to take care of a pet responsibly.
Dogs are your specialty, or do you study other animals as well?
At this point, it's dogs.
Okay.
We study.
How much do we know? I mean, I see an article periodically about the therapeutic effects that animals have on people. It's really pretty extraordinary. I'm a dog owner. I know all about that.
Sure. Well, now this area of the human-animal bond interactions is a new area of research that we try. We started identifying the huge benefits for people that have autism, cancer, cardiovascular diseases, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's a new area that we need more data.
I did see the results of the study on returning soldiers. Pretty fascinating.
So it's they're fascinating, and also like we use dogs as service dogs, therapy dogs, and even another term is emotional support animals.
Okay.
So there is that is very important to identify how dogs, pets help us as humans, you know, and how to help them. And actually, I would like to say that at this point, we are seeking further funding to scale up this study, the quality of life. Study
quality of life.
Okay. Yeah, for dogs like and that are treated with chemotherapy, and we try to have a human-animal interaction initiative where we're gonna do research and translation of knowledge through community outreach to promote the benefits of a positive human-animal bond and further knowledge between animal welfare and community well-being.
Very good, very good. We're glad you came in today, Maria Iliopoulou, an MSU-trained veterinarian. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we take a look at the latest developments in the ongoing debate over auto insurance reform in Michigan. We also hear from Ben Schneider of the band Lord Huron. That and more Tuesday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by LSJ Media, offering digital marketing solutions to area businesses of all sizes, such as website development, email marketing, optimization, and more. Information at lsjmedia.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.